Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today Mary Nichols is joining me to talk about air pollution and regulating air pollution, which she has done for decades. 18 years she served at the helm of the California Air Resources Board. She has led the fight against smog in California and nationally and has had an extraordinary impact. Really delighted to have Mary on the program today. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the podcast. Great to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you again.
And how are you?
I'm extremely well, thank you. I don't have COVID, so that's a good start. I'm traveling. I'm working hard on a variety of different things, all climate related these days, but a lot of it focused on China, some of it on more national and local activities, pretty much all volunteer boards. And
You sound so busy, but I'm not at all surprised. You retired formally, or am I right, in 2020?
Yes, I refer to it as step down from my as chair. Okay. Yeah. But yes, I've not been full-time employed anywhere since then.
Right. And so you said all sorts of international works. Have you been traveling to these places, or is it mostly Zooming?
I've been back and forth to China several times. Although one of the boards that I'm on, which is the Energy Foundation board, meets alternately between China and the U.S. But I've ended up being in China, about twice a year, I guess. Not as bad as it could be. I mean, China itself is fascinating, but getting there is hard.
Well, I hadn't planned on jumping into China, but let's do that for a second, because I've already teed you up as having been at the helm of CARB in California, and then having a role at the EPA in Washington. But how would you say? I mean, here you've got this great position to take a global look at things. How is China doing in terms of emissions? Is this still a super alarming situation?
Well, I mean, they are now the world's largest emitter, so that is super alarming. But the good news is that they are taking their responsibilities and their commitments extremely seriously. At the national level, there's a lot more actual action going on by the Chinese than there is in our country. Although, of course, with Biden and the Inflation Reduction Act, so-called, we have a huge commitment, but it doesn't use the word climate because that was not possible politically. Whereas in China, they have no hesitancy about saying that they signed the Paris Accord and that they're committed to moving towards net zero. And they publish their emissions data, and increasingly it's reliable. They are looking to position themselves well in the international arena, and they're not doing everything that we would like them to do. For example, they have not stopped building coal-fired power plants, so they're still getting an enormous share of their energy from coal-fired power. On the other hand, they're also building renewable energy installations, wind, solar, hydro, at a much faster rate than anybody else in the world. And increasingly, they're turning their foreign aid, which is always, tied to their global political aspirations, but they're using climate as much more of a metric in the investments that they're making in other places as well. So, all in all,
pretty impressive.
I would have to say that in general, I think they deserve credit for effort and actually for a lot of accomplishment as well.
Yeah. Right. And then I know also on the electric vehicle front, BYD, biggest EV maker in the world, and you got the wind and the solar. Right. And I remember traveling in China not that long ago, and the people that I was meeting with said, now just remember, Ted, that we're the world's factory, right? We're manufacturing all the stuff that you Americans and others are buying. And so I guess even from a carbon accounting standpoint, we're not doing accounting like that. We're not saying that you know, it's our stuff, and therefore the emissions from those factories in China are our emissions, right?
No, but it's true that the U.S. outsourced a lot of manufacturing over the past couple of decades and basically let our own domestic manufacturing go dormant. And so now we're doing a very fast catch-up and trying to do it in a context where you don't want to be adding new sources of pollution into the atmosphere. So it's a lot tougher.
Yeah. Is India following suit, or how does India stack up? And it's obviously another huge player.
Much more difficult situation in India because their economy is just so much weaker than China's is. And so they're much more focused on just, you know, basic meeting the needs of their population. The Modi government has made pledges, and they are doing some investing for sure in renewable electricity. But you know, on the motor vehicle side, it's still lagging way behind. And they, you know, that's a country where they still burn agricultural waste as a routine matter for energy. So it's going to be much harder for them to reach their goals than it is for China.
Let's back all the way back up. I think if I understand your chronology, late 60s, early 70s, you're in college. You're in Ithaca, New York. Your family's living in Ithaca. Your dad was a professor there. You get a degree in journalism, interesting. Then you go to Yale Law School, and somehow you devoted your career to fighting air pollution, right? What was it that sparked that passion?
Well, first of all, I guess I should correct the record, although I don't know that it really matters all that much. But I actually majored in Russian literature.
Oh.
I got into journalism because I was working for the university press while I was going to school, and got a job at the Wall Street Journal, which at the time was looking to hire what they called a girl reporter. And I was there as the first person that they hired because the New York bureau manager knew my boss at Cornell and thought well of our work. And in those days, the journal believed very strongly that they didn't want to hire people who had prior experience with other newspapers because they thought that they had learned bad habits. They wanted to train you from the very beginning. So I got that job, right out of college. And I went to law school a couple of years later because it was actually not, as it turned out, what my calling in life was meant to be. But my interest in the environment really came about as a result of having been in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement as a student, and believing in the need for doing activism at the community level. And the environmental movement and all the basic environmental laws of our country, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, National Environmental Policy Act, et cetera, were all being passed while I was in law school. So when I finished and moved out to Los Angeles, I was looking for a job in the public interest arena, not necessarily focused on air pollution and certainly not climate change, which wasn't even part of our vocabulary at that point. But I found a brand new public interest law firm, which was just getting started then, called the Center for Law and the Public Interest. It was founded by four guys who had all been at the law firm of O'Melveny and Myers, and they were part of a wave of around the country of new firms that were set up with funding mainly from the Ford Foundation, which was really interested in promoting this idea of nature and the environment having a say in the courts, in the legal system. So I joined them as a, you know, just as an aspiring lawyer while I was studying for the bar. And I became their air pollution lawyer because nobody else wanted to do it because, you know, it was hard. I mean, smog in Los Angeles, no question, it was a huge issue, but nobody really had any idea about what you could do with it from a legal perspective. So I got to be the one to figure that out.
Yes. And I was just sort of musing about it earlier this morning when I was thinking about you. I mean, you could have gone into water pollution, or you could have gone into, you know, land matters, but for some reason, thank goodness for you, it all worked out this way. And then that first case, yeah, you're going to correct me again, but City of Riverside was getting all the bad air being blown in from L.A.
That is true.
And getting stuck, kind of caught with those San Bernardino Mountains. And originally thought maybe they would sue Los Angeles.
Mayor of Riverside came to us, but he knew one of the senior lawyers, senior meaning like the guy was probably 33. He was the old man of our group, and asked him to, you know, bring a lawsuit against LA to stop them from polluting Riverside. And, you know, my research showed me that there wasn't really much of a legal cause of action there. But meanwhile, the new Clean Air Act had just been passed. And so I told the mayor, whose name was Ben Lewis, he was a longtime famous mayor, actually, of the city of Riverside, that we had this possibility that we could sue the EPA and tell them that they had to produce a plan which would force LA and the auto industry and others to clean up the pollution that would then help Riverside. And so he was more than happy to do that. And that was my first case and one of the very first cases that was brought under the Clean Air Act.
And congratulations. And then as a result of that, did the EPA then force the city of LA and others to create plans?
So it's a little more complicated than that. The state of the law actually requires the state to put in a plan called a state implementation plan. Every state has to do one. California had done one, but their plan consisted of basically stapling together all the existing rules and regulations that existed around California. For example, the city of Los Angeles had already banned backyard incinerators at that point, which were a serious local air pollution problem. Yeah. The state, although they had created a air resources board, or actually a predecessor in the health department, had really not tackled automotive air pollution in any serious way at all. And the EPA decided that they really couldn't do anything about that. It's a little bit of a convoluted story, but the bottom line is they took the position that they couldn't force the state of California to clean up the air without shutting down driving in the state. So their proposal was that they were going to ration gasoline and just not have any gasoline available to be sold, because the federal government had the legal power to do that. And they argued that they could enforce that, which they probably could have if they'd brought in the National Guard. But in any event, let's just cut to the chase here.
Had to be a better solution here, right?
Cut to the chase, right? The state did amp up its efforts after Jerry Brown was elected governor, and did begin to push for much more stringent standards for vehicles and other things as well, like power plants and even, you know, steel plants back when Kaiser Steel was still in business. And meanwhile, Congress extended the deadline, so it was going to be harder for citizen groups like the ones that I was representing to sue the state. And this has been a process that has been iterated, actually, over time, many times. Actually, we're in a situation right now where EPA has disapproved the most recent submittal by the South Coast Air Quality Management District. The state put in the plan for the district. And it's supposed to be a backup plan for dealing with ozone. Ozone levels have been high here. Smog is, you know, the definition of smog is ozone. And You know, we've been getting health warnings on a very regular basis this summer. Now, the standards are a lot more stringent than they used to be. And people, of course, don't want any more of this stuff that they have to have. But it is causing a real problem. EPA disapproved the plan because they said it wasn't adequate, didn't show how it was going to meet the standards. And so we're at an impasse at the moment where there's a potential that the federal government could actually cut off highway funds to Southern California if we can't figure out a way to resolve it.
Right. And meanwhile, I mean, I guess back in the early 70s and now, you just have there's been tremendous resistance to all this regulation, right? I mean, you've got industry fighting tooth and nail. You've got the automakers, the oil makers or refineries. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right? I mean, it's been a constant battle to fight for clean air.
A lot has changed. And some players stay the same, like the oil industry. There's no question that, you know, you still have the industry arguing that they're a benign force and that there's no real substitute for petroleum to fuel our economy, and therefore we should back off. And, you know, they have gone along with regulations that force them to clean up the fuels, but that certainly has been a long, hard struggle. On the other hand, I think the auto industry has accepted not only the fact of being regulated, but the reality that their future is in zero emission vehicles, either battery electric or in the case, especially the Japanese companies, they're still very interested in fuel cells. But either way, these are zero tailpipe emission vehicles.
They've kind of had the future regulated on them, right? I mean, here's what you need to do. And they found that it's a very bright future. I mean, certainly the EV makers.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to certainly take credit for the role of regulation. I believe regulation is important because I don't think in general the private sector can take a sufficient action on its own. There's always going to be somewhat of a race to the bottom, and, you know, the economics will make it very difficult for them to change without some kind of a regulatory push. At the same time, I do think that global competition and the fact that oil isn't available everywhere in the world where their markets are actually growing, including India, for example, if there are going to be private vehicles or much more in the way of truck transport, which they need, they're going to have to find ways to do it that involve some form of electrical propulsion.
Yep. Let's fast forward. I know we don't have a lot of time, so we can't go through all of your steps, Mary, but let's fast forward to 2006, the Global Warming Solutions Act, which, you know, Fran Pavley and company passed. What was it? A four-page AB 32, a four-page bill, and basically, I think it just said pretty much, you have to implement it. You, being CARB, have to implement it, and you have to figure out how to. I guess you came up with a scoping study. How did you get your arms around the implementation of an act that calls for such a dramatic? Well, we thought it was dramatic at the time, right? Reductions in CO2 emissions.
It was a dramatic reduction in CO2 emissions, and we had to start off with defining how much pollution was actually going to have to be cut out of the air to meet the standards. The act itself just said you have to get to the same levels as the countries of the world that have signed on to the Kyoto Accord, which was then the operative UN document that was designed to meet the standards or to stop global warming from increasing as they understood the science at that time. Since that time, we know more about how much reduction is needed and how hard it is going to be to get there. But even at that point, it was clear that it was a big task. We're going to have to get to 1990 levels by 2020. And we thought that was going to require about a 40% reduction of emissions over anticipated growth. So it was not an absolute 40% at that moment, but it was going to get there on that on that curve. And we approached it the same way that we approached doing an air pollution plan, which is, I think, why the legislature gave CARB this task, because they figured we could figure out a way to do it using the kind of modeling and science that we were quite well equipped to do, and the same kind of methodical approach to measuring and accounting and developing regulations that would get there as cost effectively as possible. And that's what the that was what the first scoping plan did. It included a couple of mandatory elements, one of which was the Pavli standards, as they were called, which are the direct emissions reductions from automobiles. That was already on the books. So the legislature had already passed that. That was kind of the fundamental building block, even though we were still in litigation with the auto companies over the over those standards that we had adopted, and we were blocked by the Bush administration from implementing them. But they, we added on to that a number of other California-specific regulations, including the low carbon fuel standard, requirements for all new electrical power to be generated from renewable energy sources, and so primarily solar. And perhaps the thing that was caught the most attention at that time, which was a cap and trade program, where we put in a cap on all emissions and issued allowances for the 700 or so major emitters in the state of California, you know, major industrial companies and they have the fuel suppliers, natural gas and oil, and then issued allowances, which we began to gradually reduce.
Decrease, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you think, has that program been highly successful, the cap and trade?
Yes, it was designed. It was very successful within the scope of what it was designed to do. And I'm saying that in a kind of a hedging way, because we didn't intend for that plan to actually be the major source of reductions. We knew that we were going to have to use direct regulations to get most of the carbon reductions that we needed. But we wanted to demonstrate that you could do something with this kind of a market-based program. This is something that, you know, Governor Schwarzenegger was very committed to and really made a condition of his signing the legislation that he would be allowed to put a plan like this in effect. And so we designed it in a way that it had very broad coverage, but it didn't actually bear the burden of doing most of the reduction work. So it was about roughly 18% of the total reductions, a little less than 20%, were to come from this cap and trade program. And it did that. It has done that very successfully.
And were all industries, did they all have the same decreasing cap? Or did some of them say, no, we have a more difficult time reducing our emissions, and therefore we should have a different schedule, decreasing schedule? Or
we gave out the allowances initially. We didn't sell them. Because we wanted to start this program, which was new and, you know, scary for a lot of people, with as little resistance as possible. So we created a bunch of different sectoral allowance programs where within a sector, let's say oil refineries, at that time there were 13 operating oil refineries in the state of California. We pegged their emissions allowances that they would get to their efficiency, how much output they were getting for unit of pollution that they put out. And then we took the top, the most efficient, and pegged everybody else's allowances to that. So if you were the most efficient, you were going to get all your allowances that you needed. If you were not as efficient, you would be getting only a percentage of the allowances that you actually needed to cover your emissions. Yeah. And then you're going to have to go out into the marketplace and buy more allowances from somebody else who had extras that they didn't need. So that's how you get a market. It's not exactly a, you know, a free market, although anyone can purchase allowances. But if you're under the cap, you have to have allowances and show that you have enough allowances to match the emissions that you are actually putting out. It's a little complicated, but it worked.
And but it worked, yeah.
It worked is the bottom line. And CARB worked very hard to make sure that every sector, from, you know, tomato processors to power plants, was under the cap, that they knew what the overall reductions they were going to be facing were on a three-year average. And we had to actually, you know, report on, they had to report to us, and then we had to report to the legislature how everybody was doing. And we made those reports quarterly that we were getting from the companies. And, you know, we ended up with no violations on the part of the covered industry during the course of the program, because people were able to comply and they knew that they had to comply. So
it's in that impressive sense,
it was, especially if you consider the fact that we were starting it at a time when there was a recession going on nationally, and that the market, because of what had happened with the banks, if you will remember, was the market was not in very good repute. You know, the public didn't have a lot of confidence in markets not being manipulated by speculators and so forth. And so, it, in fact, it really was an amazing feat that we were able to do that without any scandals or any real problems.
That's fantastic. And is it fair to say that California overall is on track?
Yes, although our requirements are now much stricter because we signed on to the Paris Accord, and we have net zero requirements, which means we're literally going to have to be pulling carbon out of the air by 2030 if we're going to be able to stay on track to meet the overall global target of staying under 1.5 degrees centigrade of increase in overall global temperature. There are people who think that that's essentially not possible. I don't agree with that. I think it is possible, but it is very challenging.
And I don't know if you saw the news about Google recalibrating its carbon commitment and sort of stating that they're going to suspend buying offsets for a few years, and then they're going to really try to save all of their emissions, you know, through their operations. And I guess my question is that here's this whole new thing of AI computing, artificial intelligence, that takes, you know, just tons more power. I don't think anybody saw this coming at all. I've heard that sort of cryptocurrency mining and AI and internet is, you know, almost 10% of all electricity now is used for these sort of these information sources. And so I know that they're just purchasing their power. So I guess the green requirement is on their utilities, but how do you deal with a new load that comes along like this?
Well, you have to get more efficient, for one thing. I mean, despite the scary numbers about the amount of additional electricity that's already being required in these gigantic computing centers and so forth, I think that everything we do needs to be done in a way that doesn't waste energy and uses every bit of it as efficiently as possible. That's a concept which has kind of fallen out of favor. But once upon a time, when I first started working in this area, you know, that was the mantra for how to deal with energy and the pollution that it created, was that you were to look first for conservation, as we called it, or efficiency, and then look at technology solutions and new fuels and all of that. So that's something that we're going to have to pay a lot more attention to, is just zero waste. Don't, you know, nothing should get wasted. And then after that, you know, we're going to also have to make all the equipment out there as efficient as possible. I mean, for example, you know, there's a lot of projections about all the additional mining that will need to be done to make the batteries for a world which is all electric vehicles. And today's batteries use enormous amounts of rare earths and, you know, ingredients that have to be mined out of the earth to make the batteries. But we're already working hard, industry is already working hard, and research institutions on developing batteries that use little or none of these materials that will produce the same amount of electricity. So this is kind of a circular problem, in the sense that you just have to keep running to keep ahead of all of the new requirements. But there still is this issue, which is probably the most controversial, which is that there's already too much pollution in the atmosphere right now. I mean, we're living with the results of, you know, going back to the Industrial Revolution, and it keeps on compounding in the atmosphere. So finding ways to actually suck pollution out of the air is still very much on the table as something that's going to have to be done.
Yeah, I like what you said about the circular nature of the problem becoming more complex, but the collective intelligence becoming more brilliant and fantastic. And thanks so much for being on the podcast, and more so, thank you for all of your years of service to to battling smog for the benefit of us all. It's really I'm so impressed by what you've done. So again, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. I wish it were a better day here in Los Angeles, and I wish we could get ahead of the forest fires so I don't have to ever worry about not having enough to do.
Sounds like it. keep taking your vitamins, as I like to say. I really appreciate having you on the show today.
It's been fun. Thanks.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.